I'm Simon.
And I'm Dan.
And this is the Wikicast, a podcast where Wikipedia takes us to a random article each week and we talk about what we find. Dan, what are we talking about this week?
This week, Simon, we're talking about Eudoxus, a Martian crater.
Eudoxus. Oh, okay, right. Well, this is my territory. Tell me all about it.
Well, Eudoxus is an impact crater in the Phaethontis quadrangle of Mars. Mm-hmm. I can give you its coordinates if you'd like.
Go on. Do you know me?
Yeah, it's 44.9 degrees latitude, mm-hmm. South latitude, and 147.5 west longitude.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. It's 98 kilometers in diameter.
Whoa!
And was named after Eudoxus of Cnidus. And the name was approved in 1973.
So it's a pretty bloody big crater.
Yeah, huge.
So 93 kilometers. Because like, that's the thing about Mars, is that it has some of the biggest geological features of any planet that we know of. Like, yeah. It's got the highest mountain, which is Olympus Mons. You've got the deepest canyon, which is a big, massive equatorial like gash across the planet. I'm completely failing to remember what the name of the canyon is. I'm just going to have to Google that. So this isn't the biggest crater on Mars, presumably.
No, I don't think so. I was just on a theme looking at there's an article on the geology of Mars.
Valles Marineris, that's the name of the valley. I've got it.
Well, there you go. Avalanches.
Yeah, yeah, you do. You get dry ice avalanches.
Yeah, February 19th, 2008. Images obtained by the HIR high rise camera on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I didn't quite get it, and I'm there now. It's all right. Showed a spectacular avalanche in which debris thought to be fine grained ice, dust, and large blocks fell from a 700-meter high cliff.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's surprisingly alive, and we actually have a surprising amount of data on it. There's actually a textbook in my office which is about the climate of Mars. Like, we actually have enough satellite observations and stuff from the ground. That we can put together a reasonably accurate model of the Martian atmosphere, because it does have an atmosphere. People think of it as being like kind of barren and waste, you know, just like a wasteland. But it has an atmosphere that, from memory, is about 98% carbon dioxide, and the pressure at the surface is about 3 hectopascals. I want to say, which is about 1,000 times smaller than the Earth. So it's there, but it's very, very CO2 heavy. But yeah, no, it's a really, really interesting planet. I actually did my extended project. My 10,000-word essay on manned missions to Mars and why we haven't... Basically, why it's... You can go to the moon in the 60s, but you can't go to Mars even now. Except, old Elon is trying to prove everyone wrong.
Yeah, he is. He's doing his best. See, I'm approaching the end of Red Mars.
Oh, how are you finding it?
It's very, very good. For those who don't know, it's part of a trilogy about kind of colonization and the terraforming of Mars.
Is it Red Mars, really, Blue Mars, and Green Mars? Is that right?
I think it's red, green, then blue, because blue would be the final stage.
Okay.
Because they can do plants before they can actually bring in the water. I think that's right. Anyway, we'll check.
I'm looking it up.
It's really cool. And one of the cool things.
Yes, you are right.
Yeah. And one of the cool things about it is that a lot of the science in the novel actually kind of stands up to reason. It nicely balances kind of, it starts off pretty basic, but then throughout the novel, because you become accustomed to it. Yeah. So it's interestingly enough, in this Geology of Mars Wikipedia article, in that first paragraph, from the Greek area, sometimes appears as a synonym for Mars. Yeah. Sometimes appears as a synonym for Mars's geology in the popular media and the works of science fiction, e.g. Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy.
I mean, would you recommend it as a reading experience?
I definitely would. I think as far as kind of science fiction goes, he's one of the best for sure.
I've been meaning to read it for a long time. It was a book that my English teacher at GCSE recommended to me, because I was writing at the time. I was working on a novel, and he thought that the thing that I was lacking was dialogue, was my weakest bit. So he recommended I read Harold Pinter, and reading Red Mars. As also just kind of for the style of thing I was going for, which was very sparse, like kind of not even post-apocalyptic. It was like humans in a barren landscape type thing.
See, I'd never read fiction. I'd never read science fiction.
I never read any fiction before.
I definitely have read a lot of fiction.
Look, the events of this book, they didn't actually happen. Like, yeah. It was mind blown.
It's all, yeah.
It makes those Harry Potter documentaries look really tame by comparison.
Yeah. it was a really, I think it was as far as kind of a foray into science fiction. I've really, really enjoyed it. It was interesting that you mentioned Pinter. I did a load of his stuff from my, one of my higher level courses in the IB was theatre, which is more theatre in the making rather than theatre in the practice, which is quite cool.
Now, it's been a long time since I looked at it, but is it The Waiter or is it The Dumb Waiter that's by him or something like that?
Oh, gosh. I can't remember.
Or is it The Caretaker. Furious typing. This is half of this podcast. Yes. Yeah. Harold Pinter, The Caretaker.
Mm.
But I also, because we didn't do any of him in English. I remember we did an Inspector Calls, which was really, it was one of those classic ones that's like really, really heavy-handed symbolism that it's just about obvious enough for idiot children to get. And by idiot children, I don't mean the other people in my class. I mean everybody in my class, because children are idiots. You know, like, it's amazing how at every age you think you've really got a firm grasp on the world, and you think, oh God, I'm so much smarter than I was like a year ago. I've got a much stronger hold on reality. But you think that every year, which means that just taking that forward, you will always view past you, even a day past you, as an idiot. I certainly do.
Yeah.
Going back to Mars, did you read The Martian by Andy Weir?
No, I haven't.
It's excellent. If you like Red Mars, it's in the house, actually. I've got a copy of it on the shelf. I can see Dan in the video looking at it. It's excellent, and I read it in like two sittings. It's a complete page-turner. For those of you who aren't aware of it somehow, because they made it into a film with Matt Damon, in yet another case of Matt Damon costing the US taxpayer billions of dollars to bring him safely home. He did it in Saving Private Ryan, he did it in The Martian, he did it in Interstellar.
And beautifully highlighting the ridiculous way that categories in the Academy Awards works, because it was nominated. And didn't it win comedy?
No, it wasn't the Academy Awards, it was the Golden Globe, I think. It won the Golden Globe for comedy or musical or something like that.
Oh, what the fuck? I mean, it just makes zero sense. I mean, I understand there are moments of it of kind of frivolity and it, you know, there's a degree of humour, but there's no way that you can be like, oh yeah, I'm starring in this new comedy. It's on Mars. Like, it's not that at all.
It's a pretty solid film, actually. I remember I came out and I think I'd read the book just before going in, so I was that hypercritical mode of being like, oh well, it's not quite like it is on page 75 where he uses a thorium generator. Like, it was pretty quite accurate to the book. They simplified a few things. They also managed to convey something which, because it's told in the first person as diary entries, which is kind of, you know, he's writing this stuff down to keep him sane, which kind of makes sense. And they actually kind of translate that quite well. And just looking at the wiki, I didn't realize it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards. Like, it was pretty quite
a good
film.
It was a good film. By no means perfect, but good film.
No, definitely. Much like Thor Ragnarok. We have actually had some emails in about Thor Ragnarok. And also about Blade Runner 2049. For those of you who are new to the podcast, this is the episode where Dan and I are going to talk about our opinions on the new Blade Runner. And we also have some emails in, but we'll come into that later in the podcast.
My amazing opinions of the film that I'm going to probably see this evening.
Oh, for f*** sake!
I have no time.
We've established this. You have no time!
You do, but there is a big difference. You're either on campus working or at home working. I have to be in many different places. I tried even looking an alternate sources to see if I could get anything. I mean, it's way too early to see if there was like something where I could stream it for a paid, you know, subscription or something, but it wouldn't let me.
But I saw it at like 11 o'clock at night. The times that we bumped into each other have been when I've been leaving work at like 10 and you've been leaving a rehearsal and we're like, oh, it's you. Like, we seem to, for one thing, that's kind of weird that we're like tracking together.
it's like we're
magnetically attracted.
Yeah, we're two kind of astral bodies. Just kind of we get kind of pulled into each other's.
Oh no, that's a fan fiction. If you want to write about Dan and I's astral bodies,
two asteroids by the name of Simon and Dan.
I was thinking of doing that. I was tempted to write a fan fiction of my own, but do it clearly from my perspective. It's like Bodega, where I'd be some. Imagine it was like I was Flash Gordon, and you were like, I don't know, an infant Birdman or something, like a winged monkey.
Thanks, man. Really nice.
You're welcome. I might have to do that, but oh, for God's sake. Right, well, I will be giving my opinion and we'll be going through your emails, and I'm looking forward to that because we're both massive film junkies. In fact, well, I mean, I did want to talk to you about this because this podcast is formed of a few sort of different components, and there's definitely the corner where we talk about the article, and I do want to go back to the article because I feel like there's more to talk about. That's definitely like Wikipedia corner. We have correspondence corner where we talk through your emails and answer your questions. I would love it if we had a film corner. And it's just like a regular thing every week, and we talk about stuff that we've been watching. It could be, you know, film/TV, but just, or YouTube even, just stuff we've been watching, but particularly with an emphasis on film.
Film/TV or YouTube would be brilliant because I've just finished episode 5 of Stranger Things 2. And I know you haven't seen it yet, which is fine.
Yeah, because I haven't had time.
Exactly, and that's all right. And I'm not going to beat you up about not having time because I understand we're both under a lot of stress. next week we can discuss maybe the first episode. You haven't even started season 2?
No, I've literally, my days recently have been getting into work at 9, working until about 10 p.m., getting home and doing 2 or 3 hours of CD design and other, like, I've got my videos, I've got the Oxvlog project to do stuff for, and I've got the videos from the Symphonic Evensong, and I've got then there's other videos I want to film. I haven't had time, so I've been working basically 9 until past midnight every day for the past however long it's been nuts recently.
It's been so busy trying to fit in.
The one thing I have been allowing myself has been the Divinity Original Sin playthrough by Team Double Dragon, and that has been keeping me
I haven't even allowed myself time for that.
That's like 20 minutes.
That's the one thing, because I think I got to episode 18 and then I haven't seen anything since, just purely because I'm either dashing from one rehearsal space on campus to another, or by the time I get home, the last thing I want to do is sit and watch something that's going to keep me awake longer. I literally just get home and I'm like, right, bed.
I like watching the stuff like that to get me to sleep, actually. Like, it's just chilling. It's almost like I have friends here with me that I can like watch them play a game and then I go to bed.
I have to listen to it. I can't do, as soon as if there's anything with a screen, it's that light. It keeps me awake. So I often just put a podcast on, stick my headphones in and go to bed. Which has been amazing now that I've got a new set of headphones, which I'm trialing.
Tell them, Dan.
Ooh. So, being an Apple nerd, I invested in a set of AirPods and they are the coolest things ever.
Did you hear that?
I did hear that. What was that?
That was Michael's printer turning itself on. I think I must have pushed against the power button. So this is the benefits of me not having my own room. This is me living in somebody else's front room. So I've just got like a printer here. There's loads of there's a shelf of music that is definitely going to collapse under its own weight if like a fly lands on it at this point. It is the single most rickety thing I've ever seen in my life. Considering this, I mean, think about how much books are like compressed trees, basically. It's just like having, when you have like a row of books on a bookshelf, you're just putting however long they are of tree on the book. And these are books are massive, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stories, and they're like 3 feet wide and like a foot deep. So that thing is not going to last.
Are they really kind of like bowing out?
I'd estimate it's at like a 15 degree angle. Like it's tilted by like 15 degrees. I just don't want to touch it.
He needs to invest in one of our amazing shelf setups like we had for all of 3 or 4 months before you moved out.
Well, you still have it. It's not like I took it with me.
No, I said we, as in you don't have it anymore.
Oh. It's like after you left, we tore that out. It was too much to look at. I couldn't bear it.
Yeah. It was amazing. It's so handy. We used to have an IKEA bookshelf, which was all right, but just a really not kind of sensible use of space in the room at all. And you couldn't really put that much on it. And it was quite deep. Whereas then we decided to, with the help of...
I was going to say, if you don't mention the fact that your dad basically did it for us, it's like, we're like manly men, we put up our own shelves, you know?
Hey, I think I'll have you know, you arrived when we were doing the sawing. The actual installation of the shelving brackets themselves was done. That was a group effort from me and dad and mum barking out orders, as per usual. Love you, mum.
I can't imagine your mum barking anything out. She's way too nice. Linda, if you're listening to this, you are way too lovely to do any barking. Don't listen to your son. He's barking mad.
Well done. Hang on. Just there you go.
Thank you.
That's what he wants, isn't it? That's what you want, mate. I'm gonna bask
in it.
But yeah, we have an actual decent shelving unit which we can keep all of our books on and all of our music, and then the bottom shelf is reserved for music scores and Bev's. So I can see that we've got a fairly decent stash of whiskies. We've got two bottles of port. Oh, there's quite a bit of rum there as well.
So the rum isn't in fact gone.
No, the rum is not gone. The rum is very much there.
Actually, that's
the Tennessee honey has gone because that turned out to be Liv's favorite.
Well, you say that her other favorite was Glenmorangie, because I didn't realize that she'd been drinking my whiskey when I had my back turned. So like the bottle, I was like, I swear the bottle wasn't that low before, and yeah, she'd just been sipping at it.
Yeah.
So no, this is actually something to talk about, because the rum reminds me. Basically, this is going to be the first year ever in my 27 years of existence that I am spending Christmas Day away from my parents.
Oh my gosh.
Because I'm spending it with Liv. And that just reminded me, basically, that that was last Christmas when I came home. And the thing, if we haven't mentioned this in the podcast enough, the thing about my dad is he's a massive fucking lad.
He is.
And I will never... ever be as cool as him. Like, it doesn't, I don't think people realize this until you meet him. Like, he's just better than me in every way. It really like hit home when last Christmas I was just sat, I think I was reading or maybe watching something, and I had like just like a tumbler of Coke, just like Coke Zero, and my dad just comes down the stairs, looks at me, looks at the glass, and is like, put rum in it. Like, I was like, Dad, I'm it's like 5 PM. I'm reading. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, he didn't seem to think it was strange at all. Because I think he's been at that level of retired where he's like, well, I don't give a fuck anymore. Like, I'll do what I want.
I've just been eyeing up mulled wine. It's in the shops already.
Yeah, because it's November, which means it's Christmas.
Yeah. Well, you make fun. I just before doing the podcast, because I have the day off today, which is so exciting, and Michael Graham, being the absolute lad that he is, has allowed Chapel to cancel rehearsal tonight, which means that I've got the whole day and the evening and night, which is...
You've changed your tune about Michael since this time last year.
Yeah. Well,
we're not going to talk about that.
We'll breeze over that. There was an incident
in the Bath tour this time last year, and Michael did not forget. But yeah, Dan likes him now, so it's okay.
Yeah, we're okay. We're okay now. It's our anniversary. Yeah, and I just, me being me, thinking of a day of what can I do to kind of have a nice relaxing day. I spent the night on the sofa because I was watching Stranger Things, and the sofa is my favorite place to curl up and slumber. Mm-hmm. I then watched the season finale of Great British Bake Off. I cooked myself a nice breakfast and then proceeded to clean every inch of the house and do some laundry and then record the podcast. So I'm in an amazing mood. The bathroom is spotless. Ed did all of this while playing Battlefield 1, so he was a massive help. thanks to Ed there. Absolutely love it. But he's going out to lunch, so... I'm not quite sure how he's doing that because he doesn't have any money, but
he'll ring you up in a sec. In this podcast, he'll ring you and ask for money.
Yeah, he's vacated the house, so we can, this podcast will be interruption free, because last week he did actually come in. I don't know if you heard in editing.
No, actually, that was impressively quiet. I did not hear that.
Yeah, he came in through the door and I just kind of held my hand up and kind of started waving it to be like, shut up. And then he just crept through the house and upstairs. Which is quite, it was actually quite impressive. I'm very
yeah, wow, I had no idea. Stealth suit Ed Dunn, wow.
Mm. Yeah. Soft-footed.
So, basically, this is the first Christmas I'm spending away from, like, Christmas Day I'm spending away from home.
Sorry.
Because
what a f***ing tangent, Jesus.
Well, I go on a tangent in this podcast? Yeah, so I was just wondering, like, this feels like really becoming an adult. What are the other things that you've done? Because you had a somewhat different childhood, because you did spend time away from your parents, but being in different countries. Right.
Yeah, I spent about just over a year, I think it was, away from mum and dad when I stayed in Australia and they went back to the Netherlands to live. So that was kind of a pretty strong kind of wake-up call as far as just learning to be a bit more kind of independent. Obviously not kind of fiscally independent, because I didn't have a job. But that certainly kind of taught me to kind of rely on myself a little bit more. I think the true independence came when I was in halls at uni, so I was just naturally spending more time away from mum and dad in a kind of, still not quite as far away as Australia is to Europe, but coming into second year and moving into this house was a huge change, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's when you're having, you know, I had to set up the internet and kind of make sure all those bills are all right and pay the gas and electricity, and making sure that I emailed the council so we wouldn't be paying council tax because we're both students, and kind of doing all those fun things. And
I mean, do you feel like an adult?
No.
Good, because I don't. No, I was really hoping you'd say that.
Yeah, I feel no. I feel like I can adult, but there's a difference in feeling like an adult and functioning like an adult.
Yeah,
I think I can function like an adult pretty well. I certainly don't feel like one, and I don't want to because fuck that.
Well, yeah, because like, but when you're a kid, certainly like an adult is like somebody who has their shit together and somebody who is like the person you look to if there's a crisis, if something happens. Like, if there's a fire, you look for the nearest adult. And I definitely wouldn't feel comfortable, I don't think. Actually, I say that. I was going to say, I don't think I feel comfortable if kids came to me as, like, a figure of authority, being like, what do we do? I think under those circumstances, I would. But, like, that's when you're in crisis mode. I think it was just, like, I don't know, if you had to be the responsible adult for a group of children, as in, if anything happened, it's on you, not them anymore.
See, I recently had the, we spoke about a while ago, the Singers' Weekend Away to Waycroft. And being the conductor, that was basically like being the responsible adult in, of a bunch of children. So I kind of like, I got a taster there, and that, you know, it's tremendously fun. But I think it's certainly acceptable for me, and don't be angry at this, but it's certainly acceptable for me to not feel like I don't have to feel too adulty yet because I'm only 20.
Yeah.
Whereas you being 47.
27, thank you.
No, sorry, 27. Same difference. It's, yeah, you're getting closer. 3 years. 3 years, mate.
Yeah, but like, I mean, is 30 really that old?
If you're 30, you're basically like in your 20s. And if you're in your 20s, you're almost a teenager. So really, you're fine.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
don't
that's
question
the logic.
No, don't question it. Just accept it. I'm trying to help you here.
I mean, the thing is, if I look at people who are my age who didn't go to uni or just did their undergrad, you know, they have their shit together way more than I do. Like, I definitely feel like from doing a PhD, I'm staying in the embryonic kind of stage of being a student. I've avoided growing up a little bit. I feel a little bit like Peter Pan, you know. And so basically, I'd like to think that if I was out in the real world and I had financial responsibility, well, like I do now, I suppose. If I had financial responsibility via a regular job, then I would have grown up a lot faster. I'd like to think. I don't think I'm a fundamentally childish person. So going back to the crater, what is there anything else interesting about this? Because we've done our classic thing. We actually did talk about this one for longer than we did last time. But is there anything else interesting about this crater? What was the name again? It was named after. It sounds like a Greek name.
Yeah, it is Eudoxus of Cnidus, or Cnidus, I suppose, depending on your accent. He was a Greek astronomer, mathematician, scholar, and he was a student of Plato. So interestingly enough, we have, it's a gorgeous secular metaphor in that we've got a connection of space for you.
There we go. Well, gee, you have me on the edge of my seat then.
Yeah, and classics for me.
Yes, this is true, actually. So,
Oh my God, I just got a missed call and two texts from Ed Dunn.
What's he saying?
Okay, so bearing in mind I said that he was going out to lunch.
Yeah.
He's called me and I declined it because I'm recording this. And he sent the first message is, Dan. And he sent another one, can I have some lunch money, please?
Oh my God, Ed. Fucking busted. For
sake, Edward. So he was on a call this morning, and I when I was kind of lying, it was about, I don't know, 9:45, I was on the sofa, and I heard him on the phone, and he was talking to, I think, student finance, trying to sort out where his loan is, because in his defence, his loan hasn't come through, which is frustrating. I mean, I say in his defence, he did also, from memory, not send the application off in time, not even close. So, I'm not sure the student finance are entirely at fault, but they did say, regardless of what happened, that the late application that Ed sent has been lost. So he has to send another one.
Oh, okay.
Which isn't ideal. But yeah, I mean, I suppose the short answer to this question is no, Edward. I'm not sending you any money because I paid for your, he asked me the other day for small change. He was literally like he was homeless to go and buy some food. He's like, do you have any Dan, do you have 2 quid? Excuse me, do you have 2 quid, mate?
I need quid to get into a hostel tonight. Literally.
Yeah. Oh, for God's sake.
So I was just looking up, by the way, so to go back to the whole Mars thing. Oh, God, that's funny. Mars has been divided into 30 cartographic quadrangles. So that means that when it's near the equator, they are sort of square if you were to look at a globe. But then they're like, I don't actually know what the word would be in terms of geometry, but like the poles are circular, and then there's the bits connecting the straight edge around the equator and the circles around the poles. And they've all got Greek sounding names like Arcadia, Argaia, Mare Australe. They've all got articles, right? Yeah.
The closest crater, named crater, to Eudoxus is Hipparchus, who was another astronomer, geographer, and mathematician. He's considered the founder of trigonometry.
Oh, cool.
Hipparchus of Nicaea.
So presumably all the features are named after Greek scientists, I guess. Astronomers. They would have thought of them as philosophers at the time.
Yeah, but then depending on where you read them and depending on which scholarship you read, the name may be changed to the Latin equivalent.
Yeah.
So Eudoxus's Latin equivalent name is... is... Benedictus.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Eudoxus means honoured or of good repute. From you, good, and doxa, opinion, belief, fame, like doxology.
Because on the moon, everything's named in Latin, I think. Like Mare is Latin for sea, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess that there must be different naming sort of systems for each planet. Because I know, for example... all the moons of actually Saturn. Sorry, no, Jupiter. All the moons are named after
gods, aren't they?
Oh, I'm gonna have to look that up though, because I'm not sure which one it is. Like Europa. What are the other ones? Io. I'm thinking of Uranus. They're named after Midsummer Night's Dream characters, I think. All the moons, because there's so many of them.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Presumably that's kind of cool. We can actually like standardize all of the particular names around a particular planet. It just so happens that Mars is the Greek planet. Is there anything more interesting about this crater? Like, or is there anything unique about it, or is it just happens to be a massive off crater?
Not especially. I mean, it's got some gullies, which is really exciting. I
love
suppose.
A good gully.
Cheeky gully.
Rubs the knees. Oh.
Rubs knees, yeah. I'm just wondering if there's anything interesting about this Phaethontis quadrangle.
Riveting.
The name comes from Theon.
Theon.
Phaethon, sorry. Phaethon Greyjoy. He was the son of Helios.
Oh, right. The sun god.
Mm-hmm. He rode a chariot across the sky.
Yes.
So he was the... He was the son of the Oceanid Clymene, and the solar deity Helios.
Right. The family trees in Greek mythology are mental. Like, I've never been able to even begin to wrap my head around most of it.
There's a text. Is it Theogony? Yeah. By Hesiod. There's a book called The Theogony, which is often paired with Works and Days, another one of his works. But it's basically a book outlining the genealogy of birth of all the gods and their respective kind of family trees and how things go down. And it's just...
Oh, so it's like an official codex.
Yeah, basically. But it's like such a heavy read. It's just it's very cool. But obviously we read it in English, but it would have been originally kind of in proper kind of epic, sung epic dialect, so...
Yeah, I mean, is that a work that would have been written down, or is that a work that was sung and then later written down?
It would have been later recorded, probably. The vast majority of classic texts, certainly Greek, early Greek, would have come from an oral tradition.
Yeah.
And then would have been later written down, which is why people say, like, identities and characters such as like Homer. Chance, like it's most likely that he didn't exist. Mm. It was just because you know you can only trace the oral tradition back so far, which is interesting too when you consider you know we spend so much time translating these texts from the Greek or Latin, and get kind of caught up in which is the most accurate translation when we're not even sure that the original like the actual text that we've got in the first place is one of thousands of different kind of changes, because basically it's really interesting the way that these poems and stories would have been retold is that rather than it being memorized, you'd almost treat the story like you had a set of flashcards.
Oh right,
and
yeah.
A lot of what you'd hear would be improvisation. So they'd have these particular phrases that would keep them on track, but they'd other bits would just be kind of made up, and then they'd come back in again with these kind of consistently uniform phrases that you get across. You can change, like if you find a certain written down text somewhere in, I don't know, northern Greece, and then somewhere on one of the islands, like Lesbos or something. There'll be certain lines that are the same, and you know that from a kind of the tradition of it being recited, that would have been a standard just to keep them there and keep it all kind of locked in place. And the rest of it
yeah.
kind of made up, depending on the audience and depending on the time, and you know, it's pretty.
Well,
it's pretty
wasn't
cool stuff.
This wasn't this also the case for Shakespeare's plays, that what is written down would have been sort of like as performed, it would have had lots of variations, and what was written down was kind of like an aggregation of all of that.
Yeah, it's comparable to plays that happen today. I'm sure you know, like the amount of time in film when the people will go off script, and it's up to a director or probably less so a director in Shakespeare's time, but more the benefactors, making sure it's okay. I don't know if you read, there was a really interesting article in The Guardian, I think 2 days ago, where some academic scholar thinks he can prove Shakespeare's identity and that he is buried in, I think, Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey.
What, so is there some doubt about whether they buried the right guy or something?
No, there's just doubt whether William Shakespeare ever truly existed or whether it was like an eponym.
Oh, yeah.
So they believe, or this guy believes, that... here we go. Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford. Alexander Woch says he deciphered encryptions in the title and dedication pages of Aspley's edition of Shakespeare's Sonnets of 1609 that reveal the bard's final resting place. And when he says deciphered encryptions, they literally mean like there are like clues and hints, both metaphorical and physically how it's laid out on the page, as to be kind of it basically sounds like something out of Angels and Demons,
Da Vinci Code?
Or
yeah,
Da Vinci Code, or you know, like that kind of. It's really really interesting, but yeah, they believe that he was Edward de Vere.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I mean, when did that the tradition of actually writing a massive work, rather than it being just a written down form of an oral tradition, when did that become the norm? Was this presumably it's before Shakespeare, like it started to happen?
Yeah, definitely. Probably, I suppose you'd be pretty close with saying something like, oh no, what was it called? I did it in my first year. Talk amongst yourselves.
The alto section,
readers. No. it was, oh, this is going to really, really bother me now. Hang on. Simon, Phil, for a moment. I need to do a bit of digging.
Okay. Sorry, I realised, dear readers, that we have delved down a particular rabbit hole.
Oh, I've got it. I don't even have to look
there
it
there you go. Never mind. Never mind the apology. Fuck you, guys. Okay.
Yeah. The Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Would probably be one of the earliest ones.
Oh, really? So that wasn't an oral tradition. That was written down.
I believe so.
It was written down
sooner than, as in, like it wouldn't have just been written down because they would have heard it. It would have been a poem that was recited.
Right. I didn't realize it started so soon. Okay.
The Epic of Gilgamesh is an epic poem from ancient Mesopotamia that's often regarded as the earliest surviving great work of literature.
Hmm.
The literary history of Gilgamesh begins with five Sumerian poems, so they would have been part of a work rather than just being written down. On tablets, though, not paper.
So the Sumerians were legit as fuck. They were so cool. Like I love early ancient history like that. The first civilizations, which basically means the Sumerians, in Mesopotamia. Mm. Like, so cool. Yeah, you're really interested though.
No, I found a page about the 10 oldest known surviving books in the world.
The oldest pieces of writing are like the Temple Hymn of Kesh and the something else. There's like the Royal Standard of Ur or something like that is one of the oldest.
There's a page here saying that 10 of the oldest known surviving books in the world, so books that we still have our hands on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Madrid Codex, which is, I can't remember, I don't know when this was, okay, so bearing in mind this article was written in 2013.
Well, the stuff isn't
going
to...
That's giving an estimated...
The stuff's only going to get older since then.
Yes, I know, but like if I say a number now and someone emails in and goes, actually, the oldest is this, then...
Oh, I see, right. We have dated information.
We're not giving accurate dates. Okay. Yeah. The Gutenberg Bible...
is that one of the oldest books in existence?
One of the surviving, that's what I said.
But like, we have so much writing from the Romans and the Greeks.
Are they truly books?
Oh, I see. This isn't just sort of writing. This is, I see, okay.
No. So when I said oldest known surviving books, what I meant was, cryptically, the oldest known surviving books.
So, yeah, I wasn't taking books literally. I was just taking it to mean works of writing, I suppose.
So okay. there's a Book of Kells. The Book of Kells is kept in Trinity College Library in Dublin, Ireland, and is thought to have been created by the Celtic monks around 800 AD. The book is incredibly ornate, illuminated manuscript gospel book written in Latin containing the four gospels of the New Testament. Its estimated age is 1,217 years old.
Now
maths.
No.
Counting.
2 + 2 = 4. -1, that's 3. Quick maths.
I mean, because, yeah, this it goes on to say that in ancient Egypt, papyrus was used for writing maybe as early as the First Dynasty, but evidence is found from the accounts of books of King... Oh, my God, here we go. Neferikare.
Here we go, folks.
Kakai of the Fifth Dynasty, about 2,400 BC. So, but again... That they them to be treated, you know, like you could say a lot of the modules that I've done about early Greek poetry and things, you're dealing with fragments, which are literally just scraps of papyrus that you can have to try and base a poetry, but you can't really kind of count that as a book, can you?
But then before that, you had stuff being written on clay tablets, which is so much more survivable than parchment.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot more durable.
And before they were even being written down on tablets, having, again, back to Mesopotamia, which was such a cool... That's an amazing, amazing crash course video about ancient Mesopotamia as a civilization. And it's fascinating the way that like they kind of designed architecturally the city. They built it in such a way that all the buildings would face a certain direction, which would give everything basically natural air conditioning.
Yeah.
They had a sewer system that was infinitely more developed than you had from when kind of London was first kind of starting up. You know, London just dropped it all into one big one big hole, and then went, "Oh shit, it's not working." Literally, "Oh shit, it's not working." Whereas Mesopotamia, they use gravity, and you know, it's comparable to the viaducts. And man, people were just so clever.
People are simultaneously complete morons and really clever, and it's one of the great like. Kind of contradictions of the world, because let's face it, like, let's not get any delusions, people are mostly stupid, like it's I have a very I don't know, I don't suppose I have a terribly dim view of the human race. I think I just have a very realistic view based on just like history, you know, like the fact that, well, it's like I genuinely do believe that the quote from Men in Black is completely right, where it's like a person is smart, an individual person has the potential, you know, like they can be very stupid, but generally a person is clever. But people as a whole, idiots. Like, real idiots. Case in point is Trump.
In an answer to one of your earlier questions, the authors of antiquity had no rights concerning their published works. There were neither authors nor publishing rights. Anyone could have their text recopied, even after its contents. So scribes earned money, and authors really just earned kind of glory through word of mouth. Unless their patron actually paid for them to circulate the books. Book production developed in Rome in the first century BC with Latin literature.
Oh. So there you go. So we might have actually learned something
in the year. Oh, wow. In the year 377, there were 28 libraries in Rome.
Whoa. That's genuinely quite kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so, you know, we got to stop. We have got to stop because we're actually teaching people things. And I think we should take a trip to our newly minted film review corner.
Okay, let's do it.
So, what did you think? What did you think of? No, we did that joke last time. Dan doesn't have an opinion on Blade Runner 2049.
I have an opinion on the original Blade Runner, but again, we spoke about that last time. So.
Yeah, we've already blown you of as much information as we could possibly get.
I don't know. Just out of curiosity, though, have you watched? There's two really excellent documentaries about the making of Blade Runner.
I've seen one.
One of which was made by Mark Kermode.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I remember when I first heard that, I thought that was interesting. I'll have to try. I don't know if I saw that one.
I watched them both, and they're well worth watching.
Because, it was a very troubled production. Yeah, very, very interesting. Right, so...
For readers' benefits, it's the documentary is Dangerous Days, Making Blade Runner, and On the Edge of Blade Runner.
Yes, I think I saw the second... Well, I think I saw On the Edge of Blade Runner.
Yeah, so On the Edge of Blade Runner is the one that Mark Kermode, like, hosts.
Oh, okay. No, that actually, yeah, that does ring a bell. Yes. No, I think I did see that one. Yeah. Yeah.
It's available both of them are available on, On the Edge is available on YouTube.
Right. That must be where I watched it, actually. But yeah, so, okay, we're not going to talk about the original Blade Runner. We're going to talk about Blade Runner 2049. So we've had a couple of emails coming in about this, as we mentioned last time. Just to give my two cents on it, I'm going to preface this review by saying that I, as I mentioned last time, really loved the original. It is a techno-noir fantastique and is just like, it's so iconic and it sounds and looks amazing, even if like bits of it are definitely dated. And I know it's quite different from what Philip K. Dick, like the book, Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, was like. I think this film is arguably closer to the book from the synopsis that I've read. I think you have to view something like this, like a sequel of this pedigree, you have to view it in the context of the previous film. You can't view it in isolation. You just can't disentangle it. And I think in that sense, the film is just a complete triumph. Like it feels like it's in the same universe, but it feels like that universe if you actually watch the original Blade Runner, the shots of it's almost like everything's shot on a long focal lens, a long focal length, like everything's quite tight in, and that's because they just didn't, computer technology didn't exist and they didn't have the money to do gigantic sets, and Denis Villeneuve has those tools now, so he can have these shots of the car flying over the city and it's massive and everything's flying past, and you know, all these landscapes that wasn't possible to film before. So yeah, it does look different. And it feels airier because of that. There isn't the oppressive constant darkness and rain that you get in the first one. It does actually vary it a bit, but it feels like it's in the same universe. They've actually moved the lore on, I suppose, because technically the first Blade Runner took place in 2017, I think. So you know, like there is definitely it's not really sufficient to say the far future anymore, like it would have been in the 80s. Like they've advanced the lore, and there's like an event that happens called the Blackout, which is kind of important to the plot. But this isn't going to be a spoiler review, I'd like to point out, if anybody's concerned about that. The plot's been advanced, so it does feel like things have been moving, and there has been some calamity in the past which has been recovered from, which is why things are a little bit different. But I think most importantly, it actually... It covers the same concepts as the original Blade Runner. It talks about humanity, what it means to be human, and where human's integration with technology, kind of where that boundary is and how it gets blurred, which is what the original was about. I actually think this delves into these themes in a much more satisfying way. The original Blade Runner is just like, there's the idea. Ooh, isn't that cool? And then it just kind of frames the story around it. Whereas this actually explores some of it. And it's so refreshing to get that in a massive budget film. You just don't get films these days that actually reflect on huge topics like that. I think when we went to see Dunkirk, we liked it because it actually did kind of... delve into that a little bit, basically about survival and about, you know, it wasn't just an action film with no consequences. There were some ideas in it. And that definitely felt like in this. So I came out of the cinema and I was like, you know, it was just fantastic to see proper sci-fi with big ideas, like episodes of The Next Generation that they dedicate to what does it mean to be human, or racism, or sexism, or whatever, and they actually do it in a big budget way, then it looks and sounds fantastic. I really like the score. The cinematography is fantastic. Roger Deakins, please get an Oscar this time around, because my goodness, you're overdue for it. In terms of the performances, I really like Ryan Gosling's performance. I just can't help but get a little bit annoyed at Ryan Gosling, because he's got perfect fucking facial bone structure and is just gorgeous and perfect eyes. And you can't help but kind of hate him, but it's a great performance. Harrison Ford's great in it as well, actually. It's the best I've seen him act in ages. Jared Leto is like one of those figures that he's the villain. Well, except you don't really get to see very much of him in this. He's a figure that is quite divisive, but I quite liked him in this. He didn't bother me too much. Ana de Armas, I think that's how you pronounce her name, who's the leading lady, if you like, who's a hologram, which is very cool. Very cool, to quote the Nerd Crew.
Me personally, I love the film.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I did actually love this film, and I'm not just being paid by Sony to do that. Oh, that's the other thing, is that from the original Blade Runner, there's lots of product placement in it, including stuff for, like, Atari, and I think maybe Pan Am is in there, and Sony. And what's kind of cool is that in the adverts in this film, they still have adverts for Atari and Sony, because, you know, in the world of Blade Runner, those companies never collapsed. Well, obviously, Sony didn't collapse, but, like, you know, Atari is still going strong and is a massive thing. So I thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, Ana de Armas was very cool. Also happens to be one of the most beautiful people I think I've ever seen in my life. So, you know, that's a plus. But generally, and Robin Wright, that's another one. That she gave a, it was a underused, like, definitely I wanted to see more from her, but she was cool in the film. If I were to criticize it, I'd definitely say that it didn't drag. And I didn't notice the runtime, but it is definitely slow-paced. But I don't think that's necessarily a criticism, actually. I think that's just different. Again, it deals with big films, with big themes. And it does it at a slow pace, which is, again, refreshing. But there were certainly times when I was like, there's a scene where he finds, and I'm going to be cryptic here, Kay finds something. And there was a shot where I was like, why is this shot still going? Like, I feel like this needs to be about half as long as it is, and like the music, it's like very profound moment, but like I was like, come on, like this is a bit too slow now. I definitely criticize it for that. I don't know, really. I when I came out, there wasn't very much negative I had to say about it, and thinking about it now, I just really it was, I think refreshing is the key thing. It was different, it was a slow burn film, and I just really liked it. And hopefully when you see it, we might have to have a little quick addendum next week for your take on it. I think you'll like it. I really, really, because you like Dunkirk so much, I think you'll like this.
Yeah, I'm so keen to see it. And equally with your thoughts on Thor Ragnarok, I'm really, really curious to see how my kind of opinions on that line up with yours.
I kind of want to see it again. I wouldn't mind seeing it with you, actually.
What are you doing tonight?
Editing.
Okay. Cool, because it's just with no chapel. I was just looking at some showtimes actually at the moment. There's also, I'm really, really keen to see The Death of Stalin.
Oh yeah, is it Iannucci? Iannucci who's done that one?
Yes, Iannucci, Armando Iannucci.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing that actually, if I get the time. Again, time is a genuine issue. Once this CD is finished, doing the design for this, I should be a bit more free.
Because we've got to go purely because it's got our Lord and Savior Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs, we do. For those of you who don't know, he's Jason Isaacs is a massive figure in the Camode Mayo film podcast, and we also just happen to like him as an actor. So seems like a solid guy.
He's just awesome. He's just a really, really nice guy. I think his performance in the in Star Trek Discovery, the most recent.
I haven't seen this either. But you've been watching
really,
it.
It's really good. It's by no means perfect. It's trying to appeal to a wider kind of audience, not only in terms of their kind of demographic breakdown, but also their kind of personal experiences with Star Trek. the budget doesn't look too bad. It's, you know, it's riddled with CG, and for a lot of the time, the CG does actually look really good. Having said that, the amount of effort that has gone into costumes and makeup for you know, for one of the, no, I forget the name of the race.
Klingons?
Of the first officer. No. No, I mean, the Klingons are great, but there's this one, he looks a bit like a bug. He's really, yeah, it's really, okay. Really cool. And it just looks amazing. Like, you can tell that a lot of effort's gone into that. Also, really, really, what's really cool on Netflix is the languages that they cater for are fantastic, but you can actually choose Klingon in its written form as a subtitle choice, which is just cool. Amazing, you know. You know, it's you can tell it's been put out by people who really love and care about the franchise.
No, I mean, I definitely want to watch it for sure when I hand in.
But there's a load of really great films out at the moment.
So going back to talking about Blade Runner, we do have some reader reviews. I'm going to censor these because there are some spoilers in these, but there will not be spoilers in this podcast. Orpheus, who is from Switzerland, has sent an email saying, long-time reader, first-time writer, kill the animals and save the frames. Oh, wait, this isn't AGDQ. What's that a reference to? AGDQ? Hang on. Sorry, Orpheus, I'm just going to have to say AGDQ, isn't it? Or Awesome Games Done Quick. I'm not aware of that one. Okay, they've written in saying there are two sequences in the film that really stuck out to me. The first is when Kay meets Blank, that name redacted there, that's also redacted, Blank, for the first time. When Kay meets an important character for the first time, and they ask him to think of something. Apparently, I'm just going to have to, the voice is back, I'm just going to have to look through to see how to not spoil this. I see. Basically, making the point that it doesn't patronize the audience and it makes them use their brains, which is definitely something I agree with. As a film, it sometimes it does spell out stuff a little bit, but it's generally does make you think in a similar way to, again, Christopher Nolan. I felt that I, as a viewer, was directly being spoken to. It was an insanely simple yet powerful effect that allowed the audience to bond with the protagonist. Agree? Yep. And then the second moment is when Kay revisits. This isn't a spoiler. Revisits the junkyard and finds Blank. The build-up, this is all caps, the build-up was absolutely insane! I agree. This is the sequence I thought did go on a little bit too long, though. I have no recollection of exactly how long the sequence was. It could have been seconds, minutes, or years. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't move. I was totally paralyzed. The music was so powerful that it completely took over my senses. I'll remember it for years to come. My friends and I definitely released a simultaneous holy f*** right afterwards. I'd agree with that. It's like, the music is something that I should probably mention, is like, because the original composer was Johan Johansson, and he got moved off the project because he wanted something, Denis Villeneuve, that is, wanted something a little bit more primal, I think. And there are moments where the music's literally just like screaming, like it's almost like a synth scream. It's really, really cool. So yeah, definitely agree with that. Thanks, Orpheus. And then also Pam Vano has sent in an email saying, Dear Messrs. Clark and Moore. Well, I mean, of course I'm going to read this one out. A few days ago, I went to the cinema and saw Blade Runner 2049. Here's what I thought about the movie. First of all, it was absolutely gorgeous. All the animations in the street were detailed. Oh, yeah, that's very cool. Similar to the first film, there's like massive street advertisements that are these like huge holograms. Yeah. That's really cool.
The effort into detail in the film is insane.
Yeah, have you seen any of the Adam Savage stuff for Tested? He's gone behind the scenes and done like looked at the props and like the actual like physical stuff. It's amazing, absolutely amazing. It's a bit like Lord of the Rings, actually, in that sense. You could sort of see the physical design and like the production on it was top notch. Second point that Pam has made is that the sex scene was probably my favourite. It was so original, and maybe this could happen in the future as well. Now, if that doesn't make you want to see this film, I don't know what will. It's a three-way between Ryan Gosling and two women, one of whom is a hologram. Now, it works. Right. That's all I'll say. It's very, very cool. The way that it's very cool. It just kind of works. That was slightly weird watching it, but I was watching it and thinking that this is new. This is you know, very well done. And the following point, Ryan Gosling did a wonderful job. He really carried the movie. He did. But she was... Patrick, beg your pardon. I am, of course, assuming Patrick here is a guy. I was a bit disappointed by Jared Leto and Harrison Ford. Their acting to me wasn't that convincing. Leto's character had a poetic monologue, which was just nonsense. Agree with that, actually. I'm not a big fan of monologues, generally. Or, like... Yeah, his in particular was a bit, sorry. Yeah, this is really engaging to you, Dan. You're just sat here like, I don't know, like, this all...
I literally have no idea, you know. I'm also not reading these emails because I don't want spoilers, so...
This is fair. So I'm just finishing up this one quick. Personally, I didn't really like the story when I left the cinema. I felt like the movie didn't actually end. I actually liked that. It didn't really have, like, a classic kind of climax to it. It kind of did, but not really. It was meant to... It's clearly a plot that carries on beyond the film, which I really liked. The idea that it doesn't matter whether you are that's redacted, that's a spoiler. I kind of disagree with you on that one, Patrick. And then in the end, I was just a bit disappointed. I really liked Villeneuve's Arrival, Prisoners, and Sicario, and in the end, Blade Runner didn't live up to my expectations. Well, that's interesting. I've got to say, thank you for the email, Patrick. I definitely would disagree. I thought it definitely lived up to my expectations. But
there we go.
You know, people, this is the good thing about films, people disagree. I think just to make sure that you don't go completely insane, Dan, we should probably move on to now Correspondence Corner, which is just over a little fence from Film Review Corner, because
just,
you know,
over a little fence, yeah.
We're moving on from one section of emails to another section.
We're just turning around and wandering into the other corner of this small room that is the Wikicast.
So would you like to
ever growing room.
Yeah, we're expanding. We're going to put another story on at some point. Well, quite possibly, actually.
Yeah,
we're going to get
a conservatory.
Later.
Well, conservatory first, and then another story.
Would you like to kick us off with an email, I think, from Andriana?
Andriana, I think. The J would be a Y, I think, if it's Croatia, right? We'll see. Anyway, Andriana, if we get it wrong, we do apologise. However...
we're idiots.
Hello, Simon and Dan. I just wanted to tell you that I absolutely love your podcast. The topics are very interesting and entertaining, and I'm always learning something new. You make my walks to uni and back so much more enjoyable, although sometimes you make me laugh with results and people looking at me like I'm crazy. And I already listened to all the episodes that are out and need some new podcasts to listen to. Are there any that you recommend that are similar to yours? I started listening to Dear Hank and John, and I love it, but it's good to have some variety. Also, I'd like to know, what are your dream jobs? Lots of love from Croatia, Andriana.
Wow.
I've mentioned it before, and I'll mention it again. Story Not Story with Craig Benzin, also known as Wheezy Waiter on YouTube. It's fantastic. He does it with his wife, China, who's going to have a baby very soon. Which is very exciting. She's been documenting the kind of the whole experience on her Instagram and Twitter, and it's been really cool to actually be part of the journey. They're both really lovely, and they do a great job with their podcast. So I would probably recommend that. Simon, is there anyone that you'd specifically...
I haven't listened to it for a little while because I've just gone off a podcast a little bit recently, apart from this one, of course. Hello Internet, which is Brady Horan and CGP Grey. It's pretty good. That's basically quite similar to us. It's just two dudes talking, and one of them's robotic and cold and unfeeling, and the other one's Brady. So it's kind of similar to our dynamic, really. That's cool. It's not at all similar to this, but I would always recommend My Dad Wrote a Porno because it's just hilarious.
Good shout. That is good.
What else have I been listening to? In Our Time, if you like discussion of big ideas, I definitely recommend In Our Time, although Melvin Bragg can get a bit annoying. He's just a bit pretentious.
Yeah, he's getting very close into falling into the Jeremy Paxman style of hosting.
Yeah, just constantly
trying to move the conversation along, but in doing so, oftentimes coming across as quite rude.
Yeah.
He doesn't do it nearly as much as Paxman, who I personally really can't stand. Annoyingly, he was given an honorary doctorate at Exeter University last year, which I don't think he deserves because I think he's a bit of a twat. Jeremy, if you're listening, fuck you.
There you go. It's unlikely, but there we go.
In Our Time is fantastic. I was walking to work the other day, and there was a really, really interesting discussion of Kant's categorical imperative.
Yeah, I listened to that one. That was a really good episode.
Yeah, really, really cool. So the way that In Our Time works, it's on Radio 4. They have a general In Our Time, where they kind of, the most interesting and kind of general topics they talk about, but they also do breakdowns for In Our Time science, In Our Time philosophy, In Our Time history, In Our Time, you know, there's loads of different ones. So just search In Our Time into your podcasting service of choice. It's really good. It's very, very interesting, and you actually learn stuff too. So,
and then as one further recommendation, which is similar to that, I'd also recommend More or Less, which is also from the BBC, and that's basically looking through statistics in the news. And it's...
Is that the one that I'm co-host?
No, that's Bake Off.
More or less. Come on.
Oh, I see. Oh, very good. Very good. It's a very grudging golf clap.
Yeah.
There we go.
Thanks. More or less.
Oh, with Tim Harford, which is excellent. It's very, very good, and it breaks down. It's important stuff. People don't understand statistics. Again, people are idiots, and they're particularly idiots when it comes to numbers. So that's a good one too.
I definitely fall into that category. But words are cool, so don't worry. If you're not a numbers person, it's completely fine not to be.
You might be like Dan. And the other question was, what's your dream job?
Gosh, I really have no idea. I want to be doing something creative, for sure. But to be honest, I don't know. I really don't know. The idea of working in production would be amazing, either as a host or as a writer. I'd really, really enjoy that. Whether that's in a visual medium, like TV or film, or radio, I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't know. This is why doing the podcast has been a really interesting foray into kind of the media world as an oral or visual medium, rather than what I'm used to as a written medium. You know, like I've written some articles and sent them off to places when I was at school, or I did a kind of like an internship for a couple of weeks at a newspaper, and that was kind of interesting. But I think the way forward is online media, certainly for the demographic that I want to kind of address and the issues that I want to talk about. Really, if I could pick and choose, I basically want to be Louis Theroux to do his work. I think he's amazing. I think his attitude and approach to documentary making, I think, is just, it's spot on. It's hard hitting, but it's genuine, and it's also just it's interesting in the way that it's shot. The actual production value of his work is really, really interesting. So
yeah. It's evolved.
Imagine if we got him on an anniversary episode. We got him on, and we could do like an interview with him.
Oh my god!
I'd wear my t-shirt.
Oh yeah, that's true. Dan's got his own
Louis Theroux t-shirt.
I did actually want to ask that to our readers, because we've never had guests on here, and we're episode whatever we are, 15, 14?
15.
I don't know. What would you think about maybe getting a guest on?
Yeah, I think it'd be cool.
I mean, it's like...
For the 20th episode, maybe, like... Because that's quite a milestone.
Because the podcast is kind of defined by it being us two, really. Like, it's just two dudes chatting about absolutely nothing. And I feel like adding a third person... I don't know how to, so how do you basically I think we should let the readers decide if you have an opinion on that, whether you'd like to hear guests, and also if we were to get guests on, how would we do it and who should we get on. I'd be really, really curious to see.
Yeah,
and
if any of you listeners have podcasts or creators that you really admire, and you think it would be cool for us to do maybe not an entire episode, or maybe an entire episode, or maybe a certain segment, they might join us for Correspondence Corner, or they might join us for our discussion on film. That would be really interesting to kind of maybe see if we can collaborate with someone else. It could be a podcaster, could be YouTube, could be whatever.
Yeah.
But suggestions are what we'd love. So,
and then a further question, which I just sort of kind of thought in my head. We actually get a lot of emails from people saying that they listen to us on their commute, which is really cool. For if you're listening to this right now on your commute, I hope you have a great day, or you've just had a great day and you're going to have a great evening. If you listen to the podcast somewhere unusual, send us an email with a picture of you listening to the podcast, because I'd be really curious. I'd be really, really curious to see where people listen to us, because it's very separate. We just sit doing a Google call and record it, and then I edit it, and then we set it up. But like, it gets sent to thousands of people, so it'd be cool to see how you experience the podcast as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. You know, every now and then, sadly, not as much as we used to, but when Simon and I do actually get to see each other in person, we'll often pull up the podcast analytics and see how we're doing. And the most interesting one for me is the geographical breakdown of, you can do Europe, you can do the world, Europe, and then the US. But interesting, with the US, you can also break it down by state.
Oh yeah,
which is super interesting. It always reminds me of kind of like a political breakdown to see how many kind of reds and blues there are, and whether we're kind of what kind of, if the podcast was to be left or right, where would they be in terms of the state's political leaning?
Pretty sure we'd be pretty far
really
left.
Interesting. very, very, very left.
To sort of go finally, I'll take this meander back to Adriana's email. My dream job is basically what I'm going to try and do after graduating, which is doing digital media stuff, producing my own stuff. I'd love to work with others. I mean, really, my dream job would be similar to what Lewis has in the Oxcast, where he's like the he makes content himself, but he also oversees a group of people making content and helps people make their content and sort of like has a administration role in overseeing like a company of stuff, but basically being creative, and I'd love to help other people be creative, but also with a very heavy lean towards being educational and trying to help people make the most out of their life basically through getting them educated about stuff. That's what I'd like to do, so that's what I'm trying to do, because there's no point in doing anything other than what your dream is. Like, life's too short. Next, we have an email from, oh, goodness me, Ruta Zarina. I'm very sorry. You're from Latvia, I believe you say, so that's almost certainly wrong. Okay, I know there are rules for proper Wikicast email etiquette, but I can't be bothered to find them right now. That's fair. But it's, you seem to have nailed it. Dear Messrs. Moore and Clark, well, you know, you kind of nailed it.
Thank you, Ruta.
I just listened to the latest episode, and I have to agree it's probably the worst one yet. Well, you know, at least you're honest. But of course, even wiki articles can be disappointing. That is very true. I just wanted to write to tell you guys, and also thank you for not saying I wanted to write to you guys, because I hate that. I'm really glad you're making this podcast. Well, we're really glad to be making it. In the last few months, I've been struggling with a lot of anxiety of uni, and hearing your banter makes life a little brighter. Well, I am very glad that we can help, because anxiety sucks. Incidentally, if you haven't read it, and this isn't just to you, Ruta, I mean to everybody, definitely read Turtles All the Way Down by John Green, because it's a very good book about anxiety and about mental illness, especially revealing, I think, if you haven't had a mental illness. Sorry, to go back to the email. Your debate about cats versus dogs is hilarious, because I think the personalities are the other way around. Dan is like a cat and Simon's like a dog. Is that fair?
I'm not sure I agree with that.
I feel like
it's
I am
an interesting
probably...
read. It's an interesting reading of the text. I feel like you need a little bit more backing up of your thesis, but yeah. Cool.
I don't know. I could see that. I can see that. I suppose I am quite dog-like.
I don't think I'm like a cat at all.
No, you definitely are a little bit like a cat. You're like, if...
How am I like a cat?
If you don't like somebody, you're just like, yeah, fuck you. And then like walk away. I can imagine, you know how cats slink off? They'll just look at you and be like, dismiss him, and be like, no. And then walk off. That is you. That is so you.
Yeah, true. I mean, given my treating of Jeremy Paxman, I feel that's actually
in this podcast, whereas I'm like, hey guys, hey, I've just met you and I love you. Like, I feel like maybe you do have a point. She does have some.
Okay, Ruta, maybe you're onto something there.
She does have some questions. Here's a vague question for Simon. Mm-hmm. How/when/why did you go vegetarian? Do you have a struggle with it? I went veggie in my penultimate year at Oxford. I did it for Lent and then just kind of carried on. So I've been doing it for 5 and a bit years now. I went veggie because of environmental reasons. It's the simplest way, the biggest change you can make to your daily life and reduce your carbon impact. I did a video about it, actually, about how you can basically, by turning veggie, makes you have a much, much smaller impact on the planet. There are, like, animal rights reasons and things like that. There's definitely an awful lot of awful things that are done in the meat industry. You know, that wasn't the reason why I did it, but it's a nice side effect to not be associated with it. And do I have a struggle with it? Honestly, no. It's just not a problem. If I miss meat, I eat corn, which is basically exactly the same. So I just don't struggle. She goes on to say, I have to admit that I probably got way too excited when you mentioned in one of the vlogs that you're vegetarian, but I can't help but notice if anyone is. Oh, I see. Right. It's like the cold communal thing. And she's vegan. I have been tempted to try being vegan. A Pixel Girl is vegan at the moment. Or is trying to be. It's quite difficult.
When she doesn't have a bacon sandwich.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how this plays out, because she'd be like, yeah, I've been vegetarian for a few weeks now. I mean, apart from the bacon sandwich I had. Like, it's just like...
It's a really interesting... There's a really, really interesting documentary called Cowspiracy that I watched in my first year that basically meant that it changed my diet for the year, and that I'd only have... I was in Halls, catered, and I would only have one like carnivorous meal a day. Normally I'd be like, you know, I'd have a fry up and then, you know, sandwich and then roast in the evening or something like that. Whereas I'd save my dinner. I'd normally have a fry up in the morning and kind of pile up, and then throughout the day have vegetarian and always have the vegetarian option in the evening. It was really, really interesting. It's a very, very good documentary.
It makes some good points. I mean, with people, there's going to have to be a global shift of how people think about meat, especially now that you've got massive increases in the middle class in places like China, who, of course, has lots of meat demand associated with it. There's got to be a psychological change, or it's not going to end well for the planet. It's not going well at the moment. Rita goes on to say, Oh, hi, Dan.
Hi.
We have a few things in common, too. I did the IB as well, and I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. Back in 2007, I practically lived in a Harry Potter fan forum and learned English by reading Marauders era fan fiction.
Nice.
That's very cool. Nice. She also
I remember there was some time last year where I properly got into fan fiction, and there's some creepy stuff, and there's some really, really raunchy stuff. And I'm not going to lie, I absolutely loved it. Let's just say that there was a scene I remember reading with when Harry was staying at the Burrow, and he was with Ginny, and it involved him casting Muffliato on the door. Door of the bedroom. Holy shit, guys.
Not the only muff.
Right, that was. Whoa, not the only muff indeed, Simon. Well done. Classy as ever.
She's also sent us a link. I don't know, are you looking at the email at the moment?
Yeah.
Click the link, because there's a dictionary of Harry Potter terms in English and in Latvian.
For God's sake.
I think this is the section of the podcast where we humiliate ourselves. Although, to be fair, a lot of these are quite similar. But for example, I just don't know how to deal with these like accents on words. Like Boy Who Lived, for example. Can you navigate to Boy Who Lived and try and pronounce that for me, please?
Okay. Is Zivo Juseis Zens?
There are how many consonants in a row? There's Z, D, Z. Is Zivo Juseis Zens? I literally don't know.
Yeah, that's nice.
This is
bless
really
you.
Impenetrable.
Bless
you. Oh, thank you. Could you possibly pronounce the Committee for the Disposal of Dangerous Creatures in Latvian for me, please?
Whereabouts is that?
It's in between Comet 260 and Committee on Experimental Charms.
Okay. Bistamu radijumu.
I mean, I would pronounce it, but that's exactly what I would have said, so it doesn't seem much point. Tell you what, I will do one. Could you possibly... Oh, hang on, where is it? Oh, I could have to find... Yeah, right. I'm going to try and say something, and I want you to follow it with the word ooh.
Okay.
Okay, so... Kinas ugun slode.
Ooh.
That, of course, Chinese Bible.
Yeah, nice.
Chinese
Fireball. I didn't even look at it, and I knew exactly what this was going to be. Chinese Fireball. Ooh.
Thank you for that one, Rita. I like that. That's all. Greetings from a library in Copenhagen. Ah, I do like Denmark. I'd love to visit Denmark. Yes, thank you, Rita.
Also, age is a compound fraction.
23 and 11 twelfths. Like it.
Superb.
That's a Dr. Jonesism you've picked up. Superb.
Super.
Tenors, you shall come in on my first whistle.
Altos, you will go on my second
whistle.
We've got an email here from George M. It's a short one. It's Coral Sponge Dance Corner. Dear Comic Sans haters, in my last email I made Simon so angry he had to eat jelly beans. I'm not sure if this is a bad thing or not. I'm currently in a third year of a Masters of Physics, an astrophysics degree, and I have a lecturer who writes all his lecture sides in Comic Sans. Also, as to the cat or dog argument, I prefer Comic Sans. Kind regards, George.
Yeah, George written in yellow on a white background in Comic Sans. You glorious...
Amazing.
That's you've become the Sips of this podcast. I love it. Following up from our film discussion earlier, there's actually an email here from Keegan Amreen, who has written to us before. Gentlemen, nice way of getting around the order. I quite like that. First, I don't agree...
Good.
With Simon's assessment of the previous week's episode being primarily nothing, I love banter as much as the next guy, but I'm mostly here for just plain chatter because I think you're interesting people who talk mostly about interesting things. You'll never hear me complain about choir content. I would definitely not call this your worst episode, though to be honest, not sure which would qualify as the worst. Well, thank you. That's nice to know you're on our side.
Man.
He has also said, also, yes, Dan, you should watch Airplane. You really should watch it. It's the funniest film ever made, in my opinion. Now, he's also basically talking about the idea of favourites that we talked about last episode as being something that like something you enjoy rather than something that's objectively good. And he's given his favourites, which are The Lord of the Rings as one film, which is it's slightly cheating.
Extended edition, obviously.
The Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which is, I think, very understandable. Love that film. It's a Wonderful Life. I've not seen that. I know it's the one with Jimmy Stewart in, and I know it's a classic, and I know I should watch it, but I haven't seen it yet. And Moulin Rouge, presumably you've seen that.
Brilliant. Yeah, of course.
Love Ewan McGregor.
Hopeless romantic, yeah. Want to live that bohemian lifestyle. I've definitely seen it.
You're the kind of person that wants to die of tuberculosis by my age. Just like to make a pretty corpse. Well, as pretty as you could hope for.
Still got 7 years, hey. I'm just going to have a really great 7 years.
You could do 2 degrees in that time. Oh my God. That is terrifying.
Amazing. Yeah.
And then lastly, The Curious Case of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Not a film I've seen.
Not a bad film.
It's David Fincher,
isn't
it?
It's not bad. I think so.
Because I really like David Fincher.
Is that also Matt Damon?
No, that's Brad Pitt.
Ah, you're right.
Keegan finishes the email by saying, "Don't let yourselves get too breakdowny, your internet friend, Keegan. Thank you. My breakdown last time was really quite something to behold when I was editing." So,
got another email here from Alex Nash, subtitled Thor Ragnarok. "Dear Dan and Simon, sorry Simon, but the other way sounded weird, like Dad and Mum." Yeah, I get you. Yeah, it just feels right, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I disagree, but all right.
"Love your podcast and everything like that, but I felt exactly the same as Simon when it comes to the new Thor film."
Oh, don't read on. There's spoilers. hang on. Let me paraphrase.
"As it was pretty much a non-stop comedy," I think kind of sums up.
It feels the
same way.
He then at least does good on you, Alex, for prefacing your spoilers with a massive all caps spoilers.
Yeah.
I completely agree with your criticism. I will say that. Sorry, I've completely swept in there on your email. Sorry. Over to you.
Given that rant is over, which I didn't read and couldn't, just wanted to say that last week's podcast was rather enjoyable, even if you didn't think so. That's from Alex, age 15 and 8/12 years old, from Birmingham.
No, I like the fact that that was exactly how I read it in my head as well, because he spelled it as Birmingham.
Nice.
Next, there's an email here from Jake. How would you pronounce that surname? Leia,
I guess, yeah.
It's L-E-Y-H-R. Leia.
Oh, Ed's here. Ed's just arrived.
Oh, go on. Is he going to ask for money? He literally is going to open the door and be like, "Damn, mate, have you you got any spare change?"
Edward? I'm recording.
I know.
How was lunch?
Lunch was very good.
Who paid for it?
Someone.
Wasn't me. I saw your call and your text, and we spoke about it on the podcast. Well, I'm glad that you've got some food in you. Okay, so Simon, you were saying. Jake, yeah, Leia, I would pronounce that as.
So Jake says, "Dear Messrs. Clark and Moore," thank you. "I have a question mainly for Simon, the answer to which might be slightly biased given the timing. What do you think about the convention of writing up all of your work into a thesis at the end of a PhD versus the slightly newer system that seems to be common in at least some European countries, where instead of working for 4 or 5 years and then writing up a massive thesis at the end, you do regular publications and then you just bind them together back to back and you slap an overview at the beginning and submit it. This strikes me as a much better way to encourage publications and write better, breaks PhD into more manageable chunks and reduces the workload." I completely agree, honestly, because the way that we do it in the UK, and I think you do it in the US as well, to do a massive thesis, you never write a thesis again in your life. You never write anything close to it unless you do a textbook. It does, and it's nothing like what you do in academia. You know, the way that academia works is you publish papers. So it does seem silly to me that you don't get assessed on submitting papers, like you suggest, like do a 2 or 3 papers or whatever it is as your thesis. I completely agree. I think it'd be much less stressful doing it that way, especially considering I'm right in the middle of the stress of writing up at the moment. I had a great morning writing up my thesis today. I was just like, blam. I'm rewriting this new chapter, and there's 6 or 7 pages now, this new chapter at the beginning. And I'm like, holy fuck, this is good. Like, this is like real science going on here. Like, oh, look at that fucking graph. it's very good going at the moment. But yes, it's very stressful. As you've heard, I'm working all the time. So it's somewhat biased, but I definitely agree with you, Jake, that this new way of doing things in the European way is just better, I think.
Got an email here from Dan H. The subtitle, Did You Ever Hear the Tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise? Very nice. Very nice. Well, I'm not going to tell it to you. I'm not a fucking Sith. Is how the email starts.
Strong. Very strong.
Dear Messrs. Clark and Moore, Clark is the only part of this email that is font typed to Comic Sans, and it's also rainbow. Oh. Sorry, Simon, price of being first, says Dan. He says, I'm a recent reader of the podcast. Thanks, Imogen. So Imogen's actually, she's in the choir with us. And read it on my walk to work every morning. It helps me pass the time with a style of witty and tangential banter, although softcore pseudo-erotica eight in the morning is a bit weird to start the day.
So this is her
very
brother.
Very true, I agree.
Presumably.
Yes, yeah, this is Dan. Who I actually met in, Bath when we had a, chapel choir went up there for a tour.
Very cool.
And he's an absolute lad, and he's hopefully going to be coming down to Exeter soon, and we'll go and get drinks, and probably go to Board or something.
Well, hey.
Yeah, he recommended, I don't know if you know this play, he recommended a cocktail bar in Bath called, I think it was the Black Horse.
Don't know. I don't know cocktail places in Bath.
Or something about a horse.
I think there is a pub called Black Horse.
Unfortunately, we didn't get around. But if he comes down, we should definitely either do Board or there's Dr. Ink's Curiosities, which is an amazing, amazing cocktail bar. The Book Cover, which is like a 1920s themed speakeasy, which is super cool. So
yeah,
go there.
Love it.
Dan? Get down here, please. Just a few thoughts before my question. Simon, surely your favourite font should be Computer Modern Roman.
Yes, it's a very good font.
Yeah, LaTeX default font.
LaTeX.
And every time you refer to Dan as a shrew, I can't help but think of Sniffy's drawing of Trot with the shrew eyes.
Not LaTeX, it's LaTeX.
I don't know these things, do I? LaTeX is default.
LaTeX, default latte, font.
Latte. Yeah, I think I'll find the X is silent. LaTeX. and he says, and every time you refer to Dan as a shrew, I can't help but think of Smithy's drawing of Trot with shrew eyes. He says, we hatters are everywhere.
Oh, like the little tiny walrus eyes. Like the
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I like that.
Dan, he says, Dan, it was great to meet you the other day. And Simon, I hope the PhD is getting close to being at an end. My question is, do you watch Robot Wars? And if you were enter, what would your bot be? Stay hilarious and always take the high ground. Dan, age 23 and 1,784... 1,825th.
I presume that's to account for the leap year or the number of hours, possibly. That's good. I actually am holding in my hand a Robot Wars, the official handbook for 2017 that your sister gave me because I bloody love Robot Wars. I have been. Have you? You haven't seen? Oh no! We talked about this last night. You have now got up to date on the new season.
Yes.
It's great. I am loving this season. If we were to enter. I think okay, so we're going to be a team. We're both going to do a robot.
I think so.
What weaponry would you want it to be?
Spinner.
Yeah, I mean
it's the best weapon.
I was thinking this actually. What if you were to do a spinner, but it's not a it's not like a blade. It's almost like a closest thing are probably like a pickaxe. Like you had like two. Like a rotating bar, and then at each end there's a pickaxe, and you just have that on top.
Like a warhammer.
Yeah.
So you basically, your first tactic would be for in the first maybe 15 seconds, stay away so you can get it up to speed, and then with the sheer momentum behind this thing, you just smash face, and it'd be amazing.
Yeah, or you have a robot that's like a hammer thrower. So it's just one thing, but it spins with the robot. The idea is the whole robot spins around, and it is, as you say, it's like a warhammer. It's just the sheer physical blunt force trauma of that thing rotating really fast. So it won't be as fast as something like Carbide, but it would have a lot more momentum to it.
So if there's anything we've learned from this second series of Robot Wars, it's that cluster bots are a complete fucking waste of time.
This is the third season.
No. Oh, third series.
Yeah.
It's actually season 10, isn't it?
If you count for all the old ones, which I of course watched every single one. Cluster bots. It's really interesting. Like with the prevalence of flippers and just the nature of weaponry as being so momentum based, stuff being so small just doesn't work out well. It's very, very cool.
Also, one of the things I totally disagreed with was the introduction of the fog of war. Is crap.
Yeah. Completely pointless.
It's absolute rubbish. It also, what a lame name, the fog of war. Like,
well, I mean, to be fair,
doesn't even mean anything.
that's a that is a term from gaming that you see, like, in RTSs. Like, that is a thing. And also, yeah, it is a military thing. Like, it, I presume it comes from Napoleonic era.
I just think it's a bit crap. Like, but, if you're going to do a fog of war, obviously they'd have to control it, but it would look so much better if you used, like, really dense dry ice.
I think that's what they're doing. I think it's just, like, fire extinguishers.
Yeah, but it's just, but the way that they're doing it is that because it's got to dissipate quickly so they can resume after the fog of war round has ended. But I think just from an aesthetic perspective, having something really kind of dense that the robots are going through, that if you had a robot that was very, very low to the ground, it could use the fog as like a blanket and get underneath it, rather than having quite kind of low density dry ice being used instead.
In a way, what would be cool is if there was just like a randomizer before each match, and there were various environmental things that could happen, and one of them would be that, and then you could set it up. It's not a temporary thing. It's something that you initialize from the beginning, and like, yeah, it's loads of dry ice, for example. And then you could have other things.
I suppose we should clarify for our international listeners just briefly what Robot Wars is. International readers might not have any idea what we're talking about.
It's the best thing on TV.
You're the Robot Wars guru. Do you want to give us a rundown?
It's the best thing on TV. It's you get two robots that weigh about 100 kilos each, and they have to fight until one of them can't fight anymore, or one of them is in a pit, or one of them is out of the arena, which is like, I could probably look this up in the book.
Or one of them makes the flawless mistake of going into one of the CPZs.
Yeah, and where they meet on the house robots, which are gigantic.
That's a corner patrol zone for the uninitiated.
I don't think I have a statistic here on the size of the arena, but it must be about 10 meters by 10 meters. And it's encased in two... Oh, no, it's 7 meters high. It's 20 meters by 20 meters. And it's there are 7 tons of bulletproof glass in the roof. So, yeah, it's pretty...
Which is, from this most recent episode, is much needed.
Yes, absolutely.
One of these robots went flying and straight into the wall where the audience are sitting, and if it weren't for that glass, several people probably would be dead.
Well, in one of the previous series, there's a robot called Carbide, which we mentioned before, which has a spinner that hits people with the force of a sniper bullet. That knocked a chunk off a bit of robot that went through one layer of bulletproof glass and got embedded in the second layer. Like, it's terrifying. I was actually just looking up.
Carbide's really cool because when he spins up to kind of full, like, maximum velocity, the machine just starts making this ominous, like, screaming
hum
noise.
Of death. And then when it hits, it hits, you know, it's disintegrate.
It's fucked is the technical term.
Do you know how much the Kilolot weighs?
175 kilos.
He's 741 kilos.
Oh my god!
Yeah, he's by far the heaviest. But he's also just gigantic. Is there a? No, there isn't a statistic on how tall he is. But I guess he's over a meter tall. Like he's just giant. All the other house robots are like 400 kilos. But he's the biggest. So a spinner is the answer to that question.
There you go.
And then this brings us to, at long, long last, the finale, the grand finale of The Case of the Deleted Pixels. Is this part 5 or part 4?
I think part 5, isn't it?
Yes, this is part 5. And this is the one that I've been reading out. And we are doing accurate voices for everyone in this. It's been a few weeks. But perhaps could you recap for people where we left off in the last chapter, Dan?
Was I not on... I was just saved by a drone, wasn't I?
Well, you were saved by me. That was it, because I was piloting the drone. But I then got clobbered on the back of the head, I believe, it was Sam, who diabolically had kidnapped you, and we're on the roof of the chapel, I believe. And that was where we left off. So have you closed your email tab?
I have, yeah. I was actually just scanning through Chloe's email. Chloe, I have read it, it's very cool. She's talking about, she does a lot of film stuff in Amsterdam, which is cool because we were there.
Oh, sorry, did we miss an email?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, sorry, Chloe. That's a tease then. We'll get back to the case of the deleted pixels. Chloe's email, sorry, go on.
Yeah. So it's from Chloe Van Barr. Hey guys, I'm a second-time writer and fan of the podcast since the start. Love what you do. Keep up the good work. As a film student, I obviously love it when you talk and discuss films. I think it's very important not to judge a film as bad or good all the time, even though it's very clear to you or reviews. Any film can be good as long as it serves a purpose to someone. To me, a film can be good technically, meaning well-made, good writing, or it can be good emotionally, when it touches you on a deeper level. The best films obviously do both. The most important thing to me is watching a lot of different films, art house, mainstream, indie, foreign, etc. In my opinion, that's the only way you can get you can become somewhat of an expert on film. I encourage you to watch more foreign or art house cinema. I understand the appeal of Marvel slash action stuff, but after a while it can feel superficial from my own experience. And especially if English is your native language, I think it's important to get a feel of what it's like to watch stuff from other cultures with subtitles, again, from my own experience. Thanks a bit for reading my long and whiny email, Chloe20 Amsterdam.
I completely agree with that. I think that having, it's like a diet. You can't just eat the same thing all the time. You've got to have variety.
Now, there was a film I watched last year, I think, about, it was shot in a really peculiar aspect ratio with little to no dialogue. Somebody's Son of Saul.
Oh, yeah, it's about the Holocaust.
Yes, yeah. It's a Hungarian drama film. That was amazing. It came out in 2015. I really, really loved that. That was probably one of the most recent foreign language films I'd seen.
Didn't it win the Academy Award for Best Foreign Picture or something? I know the name.
Yes, it did.
All right.
Yeah, Best Foreign Language Film. And it's all in Hungarian, and then some mixtures of, so it features Hungarian, French, German, Russian, Greek, Yiddish, Polish, Hebrew, Slovak, and Czech.
Jeez.
And it's, as I say, it's filmed in a really, really interesting aspect ratio.
Is it like 1:1?
Film was shot in 35mm film in 28 days.
Jeez.
A 40mm lens and the Academy aspect ratio of 1.375:1.
That's interesting, because it's not quite 4:3 then. Okay.
Yeah, it's often abbreviated as 1.37:1.
That's interesting to me.
If you haven't seen it, you should add it to your list. It's very, very good.
I mean, because one of my favourite films of all time was watching Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which with subtitles, don't watch it dubbed. And I'd love to watch more stuff, but generally more Asian cinema, because I know there's a lot of stuff in Korea that is fantastic, and like Old Boy, for example, and The Raid. I think The Raid is Thai, actually, not Korean. But then there's also, obviously, there's a huge amount of stuff from Japan. There's been loads of stuff from India and from China that I'm not aware of. But it seems to be a cinema that has its own kind of like grammar, if that makes sense. So I'd be really interested to watch more of that stuff for sure. Right, so that then leads us to return to the case of the deleted pixels.
Close my email. I'm ready.
Right, so we're on the roof. This is now coming from Joshua Baker, our great author of our time for this podcast.
Mm.
Hey, Messrs. Moore and Clark, hope you enjoy this, the final entry in my piece of fiction. Before I begin, I'd like to indulge Simon with the following question. Which of the 18 first founding legions do you most associate with, and which would you pick for Dan? Okay, so this is a Warhammer question. And also, great reference. So a little bit of backstory to that. The Emperor, in his infinite wisdom, after the Wars of Unification, created 20... which came first? The Primarchs came first. He attempted to create 20 Primarchs, which were these superhuman demigods, of which two... there's no record of them, that's a bit of a mystery, but there were 18, 9 of which fell to Chaos and 9 of which were loyalists, and they each had Space Marine chapters associated with them. Sorry, legions associated with them. That's the very short version. And they all have different kind of personalities. Which do I most associate with? I've always felt a real tied to the Raven Guard. I don't know what it is, but I think the fact they're quite emo and whiny speaks to me. I think I'm probably closest to either the Iron Hands or the Imperial Fists, because I'm a very defensively minded person. I don't do very well at thinking in an attacking way. I'd say the Iron Hands, because I also have that kind of quite a heavy hand in technology. Which one I pick for Dan? You know nothing about 40k lore, so I could completely bamboozle you here. What would I pick? I would pick the Emperor's Children, and I'm not going to explain why. So,
okay.
You'll just have to trust me. You're like Fulgrim.
Mm.
Just like Fulgrim. One more thing. It's been a pleasure writing this fanfiction for you guys. Honestly, I didn't know this would get such a positive reception. I'll be taking a bit of a break to focus on Uni, but I'll be back soon. Until then, keep on with the stellar podcast. Well, thank you, Joshua, for this story, because we've loved doing it, and you know, hopefully you guys at home have enjoyed listening to it. If you have, do email in, because we'll definitely read those out, because I think Josh deserves all the praise and all the acclaim that he can get. So are you ready, Dan? Are you ready for the final story, the chapter of the story?
Ready as I'll ever be.
That's a good way of putting it. Okay. The Case of the Deleted Pixels, Chapter 5. Simon woke up from his undesired slumber, his head dizzy from a knot in the back of his head. As he tried to clear his head, a feminine voice caught his attention. Hang on. Right, okay, it's a feminine voice. What am I going to do? About time you decided to come back to us! Simon shook his head and asked, Liv, is that you? As he regained his vision, he saw that it was someone completely different. It was Pixel Girl. Now, as you might remember if you've been listening to this podcast, Pixel Girl was murdered in the first chapter, so that's a turn up for the fucking books. Okay, she's pulled a Jesus on us. Simon yelled in surprise and tried to jump up, but his arms were chained to a post and he collapsed again.
How? What? But you're dead, Simon exclaimed.
Oh, God. Ha! The 8-bit woman laughed. All just part of the plan to get you and your partner here in our clutches. I don't know what this voice is. As she spoke...
Yeah, you've committed to it now, though.
Sam stepped out from another room to stand next to her. They were in some sort of warehouse, but it was empty, but for the few of them. Simon's face contorted with an expression of confusion and anger, and he yelled,
Where's Dan?
A shrill voice perked up behind him.
Here!
Dan sat back to back with Simon, also chained to the post. Sam took that moment to monologue. Oh god, really, this is a voice workout. My god. You may be wondering why we went to all this trouble to capture you two. You were close when you considered the limelight. You see, you and Dan have been the protagonists of your vlog for far too long, and we have been delegated to mere side characters. But no longer. Now is our time to reign over the YouTube populace. Well, very small section of it anyway. Dan piped up.
But it's got Simon's name in the channel. How are you going to get around that?
Oh, God, my voice.
Bah, Sam replied. Semantics.
Simon looked at Pixel Girl and asked,
You too? But why?
Pixel Girl looked down and quietly whispered,
You don't seem to remember that! You don't remember! It's been blocked from your memory, the crime you enacted against me. So you caught up with your videos. You wanted interesting characters, so you made one up!
Pixel Girl reached up to her face, and the distorted image fell as she removed the filter. Simon and Dan gasped in shock.
Was I not good enough?
Was I not good enough? Liv exclaimed. Am I nothing without this mask?
Simon's face fell. He tried to stammer a reply, but Sam spoke first.
Enough. Now we do what we have wanted to do all these years.
Wait. Sam's words were cut off by a rumbling sound. The ground shook violently. Suddenly, the wall nearest the group was ripped apart, cloven too, as if it was made of paper. Corin strode in.
Oh my god, yes.
Oh my god. Corin strode in, dropping the hunks of serrated metal to the ground. Everyone looked on in horror. And then there's a dividing line. There's like a paragraph being cloven twain here. Dan woke with a... Oh my god, it's a fucking dream. Dan woke with a start, his head racing and his head covered in sweat.
Oh
god. hang on, this is your voice. Corin, Liv, Sam, what? He lay in his bed, in his room, alone. He shook his head and marvelled at the strange dream he'd just had.
What in the hell was that all about? Stupid fan fiction got me all worked up.
I just realised your voice is Mr. Poopy Butthole from Rick
and Morty. Hooey! What in the hell was that all about?
The lad laid back down and fell asleep once more. As he sank back into rest, a single dark figure in a green cassock turned away from the room's window and strode off into the rainy night. The end.
Ooh.
Oh my god.
Chinese
goodness.
Fireball.
Ooh. Wow, that was high points and low points. My god, I'm so happy Corin made the appearance. Corin, like in the fucking Hulkbuster armor, just like comes into the room. Amazing.
I had my doubts when he thought it was going to. I thought it was just going to be a dream, but that's sufficiently ambiguous enough. Wow,
very good. It leads on for series two.
It's a season two of Even Stranger Things, The Case of the Deleted Pixels. Wow, we've had a complete arc. I might have to do a video where we put all of the episodes together, like, and put it on the YouTube channel, because that's been quite the journey. Thank you, Josh. As we said, thank you so much for writing that.
Really, really good.
But with that we come to the end of the episode.
We have indeed.
So Dan, what have we learned today?
Well, we started off with Eudoxus, a Martian crater, and had a very interesting discussion about Mars's geology and the link between Eudoxus and the gentleman he was named after, the astronomer and student of Plato.
Very good.
We spoke about... Oh, crikey. Oh, gosh.
I'll be honest.
We had the newly instated film corner.
Oh, yes, we did.
Very exciting. That's definitely got legs. I'm very excited about that.
I talked for way too long about Blade Runner. I'm sorry. There's going to be, in the waveform, it's going to be just like silence on your side.
A huge
for like 10
gap
minutes.
Of me saying nothing. Yeah.
I'll be honest. Apart from those two things, the past hour or so has been a complete blank in my memory. I have no recollection.
Yeah. True stream of consciousness.
I think, well, we talked about a whole bunch of things,
The history of oral and written literature.
Oh yeah, that was a big thing we talked about. Yeah,
that was like huge. That was, if anything, that might have been the majority of the podcast. Yeah, it was actually quite informative.
There we go, we remembered.
Yeah.
That's all for this week's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to us on your podcasting service of choice. You can like us on Facebook, and if you'd like to see our faces, check out our YouTube channel, Spongy and Electric.
Film reviews, Mars facts, and other thoughts on the show can be sent to us at spongyelectric@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Join us again for another tumble down the wiki rabbit hole.
And we'll see you next time.
That's all for this week's episode. Sorry, I'll do that again.
That's all right, mate. It's fine. Don't worry about it. No, try again. No, don't worry about it. You can take your time.
Sorry, can I do it again? Yep.
Yeah, no, go for it. Yeah.
Ooh.
Ooh. Chinese fireball. Ooh.